Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network and the New Books in History channel. I'm your host, Yorgos Giannakopoulos, and today I have the great pleasure to talk with Laura Robson and Ari Dubnov, co-editors of a very interesting and timely volume on the 20th century history of partitions. So I will first allow Ari and Laura to introduce themselves, talk to us a bit about their work, and then we'll discuss a bit about how the project came into being. So Laura, do you care to start?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having us. We're really delighted to be here to talk about this new project. I'm Laura Robson. I'm a professor of modern Middle Eastern history at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon, in the U.S. And I work primarily on the 20th century Arab world, and I'm especially interested in issues of mass violence, of forced migration, ethnic cleansing, the kinds of brutal remakings of ethnic landscapes across the 20th century Middle East. And so those are some of the issues I've been thinking about.
Ari?
Yeah, so I'll jump in. Thank again for hosting us. It's a great honor and pleasure. So I'm Ari Dubnov. I'm the chair of Israel Studies at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. My field of, you know, in research and interest lie in interwar, two Cold War, history of political thought in general, and with emphasis on history of Jewish nationalism, Zionism, and especially its very interesting connections with British thought, British imperial thought. And this is I'm connected both to my earlier work on Isaiah Berlin, and also led me indirectly to this volume. We will talk about it later on, I'm sure.
Well, great, great. Thank you. So, yes, my first question will actually be this. I'd like you to share with us a bit what led you to this project and a bit explain the rationale underpinning the volume, and if you can briefly describe the kinds of different voices and contributions we have in the volume.
Sure. Well, I think that I think we'd both probably trace the intellectual genealogy of this volume to a seminar that both Ari and I were involved in some years ago that was running at the Library of Congress for about 10 years on decolonization. And it was a broadly based conception of creating a kind of new field of decolonization studies, and included people from all sorts of geographical areas, and thinking about some of the themes of decolonization that emerge across the course of the 20th century. And so I think that this is a project that at least partly comes out of that background, that partition is one of those themes that emerged for both of us from slightly different kind of intellectual and geographical perspectives. And it seemed like something worth following up on and thinking more extensively about, particularly since it has been the topic of a number of kind of atomized national histories, but it has really not been explored in this kind of broader transnational context before.
And I will jump in and add to that transnational context that this is both a justification to having a collection of authors collaborating in a volume. I mean, there's something very ambitious about the project that wishes to put side by side three very distinct historical contexts, namely Ireland, Palestine, and the South in South Asia, the Indian subcontinent. And of course, the literature written about each one of those areas in general and the partitions in these areas is immense. And I don't want to even start to think about the linguistic skills a single historian will have to conquer at least 7 or 8 different languages, and not to mention archives, in order to do such a thing. So the transnational or international dimension of that project justified this kind of bringing together a host of historians that share an interest in these partitions, that are on the one hand well versed in a specific context, but are willing to think outside the box about the transnational dimension and how the specific a case or their specific region was not the developments there were not in complete isolation from other developments elsewhere at the time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Indeed, any form of collective volume is also a conversation among scholars, among shared themes. So that is certainly a very productive way of doing history. I just want to start discussing a bit about the project in greater detail, and I'll start with in fact the subtitle, and it is, as you mentioned, Arian, Transnational History of 20th Century Territorial Separatism. So, as you mentioned in the introduction, the story of partitions can be seen from a longer term perspective as well. So what I wanted to ask you is, what is it that makes it different in the 20th century?
Well, thank you. That's an excellent question. And this is where periodization and conceptual definitions meet. The underlying assumption of this volume is that partition does offer us a uniquely new type of political thinking and rearrangement of spaces and people, and that's of course requires us to define partition in a way that maybe not everyone would agree. But for instance, we automatically will probably disappoint the expert on the partitions of the Polish Commonwealth, though the term partition is used to refer to that context. For instance, it's very different from the type of things that we are interested in. And I would like to say a few words maybe about what, you know, partition is not, meaning to define partition by elimination. Often partition is confused with other things such as secession, that is, you know, the withdrawal of a group from a larger entity or association. Partition is often simply seen as a form of remapping, drawing new lines on maps, new borders. Partition sometimes involves transfer, as sometimes it's called the unmixing of populations. It is an element of partition, but it's not the a synonymous. And partition definitely took place in a context of decolonization, but decolonization itself is something different. And partition as a political idea has its root before the era of decolonization. Therefore, we must distinguish, if you'd like, original intentions in the 1920s and 30s from outcomes post 1945. So that's my initial take. Laura, would you like to jump in and give now, after I give the negative definition, a more positive one?
I think that the way we understand partition is that there's a difference between earlier divisions of territory from above, right, where territories are kind of redefined, remapped in some way, which I would argue the Polish division falls into that category, and partition, which is the devolution of new kinds of political authority on specific populations who are being defined as national for the first time. So, and often with imperial kind of intention and ramifications for continued connections with imperial rule, as well as for operations on the ground. So I think that, you know, we're really seeing this as a new moment. And I think one of the historiographical interventions that the book makes is to say that one of the origin points of partition is actually the Greek-Turkish transfer of 1923, in which the League of Nations made the decision to support the mass removal and resettlement of populations who were being newly defined as national. And so there's this kind of moment during and after the First World War where this idea of demographic engineering intersects with imperial ambitions and also the rise of nationalisms around the globe. And so partition emerges as a kind of new strategy for imperial continuation. And it is really a new political phenomenon in the 20th century, we would argue.
Right, thanks. Well, being Greek myself, I'm a bit of ashamed about the comment that the negative as well story of the Greek Turkish exchange of population, what it brought forward, but nonetheless. I actually, starting with what you said now, Laura, about this, I wanted to ask, and Ari maybe talked a bit about this, if we were to think of partitions, to do with space and population transfers to do with movement across space, voluntary or involuntary, right? So I'd like you to clarify a bit the relationship or the conceptual relationship, if you will, relation between population transfers as they have occurred in the 20th century and partitions before we move on.
Right. I think a metaphor that I often use that I find useful, hopefully my students sometimes find it useful, is to think about a partition as it emerged in from the 1920s onwards, but as a package deal in the following sense. It is a package that definitely requires redrawing of maps and creating lines of division, definitely. But this, to that component, we need to add that the lines are now dividing not between religious groups, but between groups that are seen by those who are designing these partitions as national groups. So to begin with, this is already, we are entering an era in which, if you'd like, imperial architects already assume that they are that the minorities that they are trying to govern, they're thinking about them in ethno-national terms, which is a very new type of way of thinking, which separates it from earlier cases. Secondly, it's a post, if you'd like, Wilsonian moment mode of thinking, in which there is an attempt to re-engineer the space in a way that will create a clear ethno-national majority. So in order to achieve that, you start bringing in voluntary or involuntary removal of population if the geography will not correspond very well with that political space, and hence the transfer becomes, of course, another a clear and key component of that package deal, and of course part of what is so difficult for or sounds so odd to our contemporary ears, that in the interwar period that was not seen necessarily as an illiberal a mode of engineering. And lastly, I think that the package includes a key term, which is state, or the division is not simply because it's not simply redistricting. It's about creating separate states. And we can talk about what is the meaning of these states. So I think that this is this combination of or culmination of these several developments together is part of what makes partitions of the 20th century unique and different.
Right. It's interesting, you know, because it happens at a moment when these multinational empires have collapsed, right? And the ethnic nation state is emerging as the only viable political entity for the modern period. And so I think we can see partition, and particularly the kind of forcible making of nation states where we have these clear ethno-national majorities, as a way of appropriating ethnic nationalism to the imperial cause, right? So ethnic nationalism is in many ways, of course, a threat to empire, but this partition offers, and demographic engineering more broadly of the sort that's happening all over colonized regions during this whole interwar period, it offers a way to make use of ethnic nationalisms and create successor states to the old empires that will in some ways benefit the ongoing imperial influence across Eastern Europe, in the Middle East, in South Asia, right? So this is a way of maintaining imperial influence in an era of ostensible independence and ethnic nation statehood.
Great. Thanks. It seems to me that your book is also an intervention in the rising scholarship and literature on interwar internationalism and potentially interwar liberal internationalism. Ari mentioned this. So do you mean to say with this book as well that we haven't focused enough, or scholars haven't focused enough, on the dark side of this moment of, some people call it, the emergence of an international society?
I mean, I think it's hard to find a light side to the emergence of this internationalist moment, in all honesty. You know, this is an extremely destructive kind of set of operations that we see unfolding, you know, across the globe during this period. I think that in general, we have not sufficiently acknowledged the colonial and imperial basis of this new international order that emerges in the 1920s and 1930s. And this is one way where the historiography on partition has really been insufficient, because it has presented partition as emerging from national frameworks that were already extant, rather than understanding it as an aspect of decolonization and an aspect of installing older forms of imperial privilege into this new internationalist system as a way of dealing with some of the challenges to empire that come up during and after the First World War. So I think it is a history of the dark side of internationalism. And in fact, it might suggest that internationalism in the interwar period is essentially a dark history.
Right. I would even add to that, that in, you know, using the metaphor of a dark side, it is also the story of the dark side of nation making in the post-war era. So in a sense, we have here the perfect storm, because both we tend to look at interwar internationalism through this kind of prism of you know, idealism versus realism, and the noble-minded policymakers that were thinking about a better global order to prevent future wars, but also part another, you know, difficulty in the historiography and the challenge we had to tackle had to do with the fact that, of course, you know, national histories that were written in the areas in the new states that emerge out of partition know that these new states are products of, are consequences of partition, but they would often steer away from talking about the gruesome price. It would be seen often as the pangs of birth. You know, these are the pains that creation of a nation state requires, and these are type of historiographies that are marked by a very clear teleological assumption, reading the history as leading almost inevitably to that miraculous moment in which this leader or the other declares national independence, and the other side of that independence is often the partition that is taking place on the ground, which is would be seen as kind of a we don't want to talk about it too much.
I mean, to take the conversation to more concrete aspects, you talk a lot about three case studies, and as you mentioned already, we have these two moments, as it were, the moment of the interwar period and of the post-war period of former decolonization. So I wanted to ask you if you can explain and expand a bit on the specific case studies that you're focusing on, and why choosing these specific case studies.
Well, I think it became clear to us when we were thinking about partition initially that all of the kind of paradigmatic cases, early cases of partition, happened within the framework of the British Empire. And so that suggested to us that, in fact, there are networks and kind of channels of communication and even kind of exchanges of personnel among these spaces that suggest continuities among them and between them. So I think that this is where one of the ideas that we make use of in the volume is Edward Said's idea of a traveling theory, an idea that is born in one place and then through a series of kind of webs and networks is transmuted to another place and then, of course, transformed by its contact with local circumstances there. And partition is one of those ideas. And these case studies are especially useful to consider together because it is possible to trace material connections, specific connections among the three of them, and to identify the way in which the idea of partition can be born in one space and then moved through kind of identifiable pathways into another space and deployed there with potentially different outcomes. So it's kind of an intellectual history of the mobility of these kinds of ideas in this post-war era, as well as a history of its unfolding on the ground.
Just for the benefit of listeners, before Ari speaks, I just wanted to mention that the three case studies in the volume are those of Ireland, India, and Palestine. Sorry, and Palestine, of course. So, yes, Ari.
I mean, so I think that, you know, if we take these three examples, not simply putting them side by side and you know, drawing a, sort of a table of comparisons and differences, this is what sometimes political thinkers and political scientists did, but tracing exactly these type of lines connecting between these three cases, as Laura just mentioned, you see a surprising story of a theory that is emerging, developing, and traveling in space. So, the first, you know, stage, if you'd like, is the Anglo-Irish Treaty of 1921 that led a year later to the creation of the Irish Free State. This is, of course, the first case of partition. We have to remind our listeners that sometimes the term Irish Free State is a bit of a misnomer because technically it was a dominion under the British Crown until 1949. And on the one hand, this was a case that was often seen separately from a story of partition. It was read only through the prism of British-Irish relationship. And of course, against the background of a long 19th century struggle for home rule. But this was the first case in which we can see a redrawing of borders and a creation of two states as, if you'd like, a mechanism of maintaining, containing those national differences. And it's a very interesting moment because it takes place almost simultaneously with the Turkish Greek exchange of 1923, and it is which is endorsed, of course, by the League of Nations. So though it takes place in a separate, in a different, distinctly different geographical setting, we have here the emergence of this kind of package deal that I mentioned. Fast forward to 1936-7, we see a very interesting case in which the idea is now taken out from the storage room and put and is put again forward in the context of the Great Arab Revolt in Palestine, and specifically in the context of the Royal Commission of Inquiry that the British are sending to Palestine to look into the reasons of that rebellion. And this, I would like to mention, of course, the very violent context in which these partition proposals are emerging, and the imperial context. The empire, these are moments in which the British Empire realizes that Palestine might become a liability rather than an asset, and they need to find a way to think about it. And partition now emerges again in the proposal put forward by the Peel Royal Commission in 1937, which is discussed, debated for a long time, pushed again, once again, to the back burner, just to be put on the in the front again a decade later in 1947, at exactly the same time that partition becomes the major way of thinking about the end of the British Raj in India and the emergence of a two-state theory that starts imagining a separate India and Pakistan. So these are the three, if you like, cases and also, in a way, stages in the story.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And in these cases and stages, there are continuities in terms of the actors, be it British liberals, be it imperial bureaucrats that are involved in planning, thinking about and executing these or proposing these partitions, Laura?
Yes, absolutely. We can trace some of the same personnel, the same colonial personnel who are moving from Ireland to Palestine. It is notable, in fact, that the British military response to the revolt in Palestine from 1936 to 39 involved some of the same actors who have been brought in to put down the Irish rebellions of the earlier period. And then, of course, we have some of the same people moving from Palestine to India and operating within the British colonial administration. But I think, too, that it goes beyond these kind of specifically British colonial and decolonizing networks of bureaucrats and officials, but also into this broader kind of internationalism where this traveling theory of ethnic separatism, which has been given, I would argue, new life by the successes of Zionism in the interwar period, has entered into the kind of international conversation about the making of a new global order. So I think it is a British story. It is a British imperial story, but it goes beyond that as well. It's also a story about the making of, you know, a new global order. What will this global order look like? What are the viable modes of political institutionalization during this period? And the answers to those questions increasingly become an answer of ethnically purified or at least clear majority ethnic nation states. So I think that it's a history that is simultaneously a history of empire, history of decolonization, history of nationalism, and history of international thought.
I would even add to that another dimension. This is, of course, that we shouldn't be tempted by, you know, falling into this assumption that partition is only, if you'd like, sort of a copy-paste method of the imperial metropole, only civil servants that are moving in space and are thinking, whatever I use in case A is now applicable in case B. A part of what makes the dynamic fascinating and complicated is also what we may even sort of call sort of an analogical imagination that you can see among the local population. So in a way, the national actors in these spaces are very busy reading foreign news. They understand that there are other developments in other parts of the empire that might be also relevant for them. So when they are coming and developing their political vocabulary and demands, they are using examples and cases from other places or looking at other places as a cautionary tale. We mustn't fall into the same trap like the thing that happened elsewhere. So this is another kind of element or dimension of this transnational space.
Yeah, just to give an example of that, you know, we can see that really clearly in interwar Zionist thinking, where people repeatedly, over and over again, bring up the question, the model of the Greek-Turkish exchange as a potential kind of model of success for ethnic transfer and the making of kind of ethnically purified nation states. So there are very kind of clear examples of the traveling theory idea on the level of national organizing, as well as imperial organizing.
And I think to add to this, the Greek-Turkish exchange and that model also to some extent influences discussion about the partitions in India later on in the post-war period. Ari, you raised an excellent point, and I just want to bring it up again and ask about the volume as a whole. One can obviously tell that story, the story of partitions, as a top-down story, if you will, but also as a bottom up, as a story from the bottom up, from the local context in which these events took place. So I just wanted to ask, in terms of the balance of the volume as a whole, which is an edited collection, can one find both perspectives, and can you give like one or two examples of how these two different perspectives correlate, come together?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Our attempt was exactly to bring these two sides together. So, for instance, if you look at Faisal Devji's wonderful article about the way in which thinkers from the British Raj started to think about themselves transitioning from minority to nation, this is a clear example in which you have the local intellectual thinking in these terms, not simply following a top-down type of order coming from the British metropole. Kate O'Malley's wonderful article, Indian Ulsterization, shows you how people are constantly comparing. Why is it so important for an Irish nationalist and an Indian nationalist to compare themselves and see themselves. And of course, I should remind us that in a way, if you look at the colors of the two national flags, you have a visual representation of the affinity between Irish nationalism and in India. You have these similar examples of also, interestingly, when you look at chapters that we included that discuss people that were pushing back or rejecting partition or thinking about alternatives, whether this is Adi Gordon's article about the binationalist Zionists that often came from Habsburg's lands, so they were had in mind a different political set of arrangements and models, in their mind was a different, an alternative to the partition. And Joel Baining's article about the Arab liberal intellectuals and the way they try to navigate in these murky waters, both with vis-a-vis the British and the Zionists and their own community. And lastly, I think that there's also an echo later on. Priya Sethia's beautifully really rendered a chapter on the poets of partition shows you how even after the partition and after 1947, and with emphasis on the diasporas that are emerging in the post-partition immigrations elsewhere, you can see this kind of ambivalent longing and pushing and look at the origins of that of the partition. So these are cases in which you partition is central, is key, and it's not part of the kind of a metropole or the official British mind, quote unquote.
Great, thank you. Following from what you just said, and potentially to Laura and you, you mentioned in the introduction that obviously the meaning of partitions and the concept changed after the Second World War, when we're in a different setting. Do you mind to explain how these two moments are different, in what ways, the moment of the interwar period and then in the post-1945 setting, and what kind of changes do we trace in the way even the concept is used?
Yep.
The clearest example, the clearest way of thinking about this, of course, is that the empire is formally over in many respects in the post Second World War period. And so, but the issue of partition and the idea of partition as a potential kind of quote unquote solution to the problem of pluralism in various spaces remains present. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, why this is, right? Why a solution that was really intended in the first instance to allow for continued imperial influence remains so prominent in this post-imperial era. And I think there are a couple of reasons. I think one is that it continues to offer the possibility of kind of recasting imperial ties in a national frame. So there is a continued appeal for the old imperial powers. But also it has been installed, just as it was installed into the thinking of internationalism in the interwar period, it has now been installed as a kind of tool of control on the ground for internationalists coming from new institutions like the United Nations. So I think it's really notable that even though, for instance, the principle of internet of forcible transfer has been kind of theoretically removed from the panoply of possible interventions at the international level, it continues to be used. We can see that in the transfers that take place between the Soviet Union and Europe in the aftermath of the Second World War. But also, you know, it continues to be operational as a kind of a frequently referenced possibility for situations of ethnic conflict right up through the 1990s. We can argue that that's exactly what happened, for instance, in the Dayton Accords, which basically formalized ethnic transfers that had taken place during the war. So I think that it's an interesting way of examining the kind of colonial and imperial origins of something that becomes a very deeply rooted principle of international intervention in the post-1945 period and continues to be proposed even now. Particularly, you know, we see constantly, for instance, proposals of the repartition of the Middle East, of places like Iraq and Syria, not to mention the ongoing conversation about the so-called two-state solution for Palestine-Israel. So I think it really does have this very, very substantial afterlife, and it's worth connecting that with its origin story.
I think, Ari? Yeah, I mean, Laura put it so elegantly, and you cannot, of course, but agree. I think that this is, in a way, if we move in this kind of sharp transition from the interwar thinking about partition to the post-war, post-1945 thought of partition, it all sometimes seems almost as a story of unintended consequences in the following sense that I would argue that especially if we look at the currents of thought in British imperial or new imperial thought, post 1914 and 1918, partition emerged in that very unique stage or circumstances in which you had something that can be seen as an essential paradox. On the one hand, empire became a bit of a dirty word. You know, when Wilson comes to Paris and says the origins of that awful bloodshed that we call the Great War had to do with imperial and colonial competition. We cannot continue doing empire the old way we did it. On the other hand, especially if you look at the victors of France and Britain, the imperial map is now bigger than ever before. So you create partition as one of tool in a bigger arsenal of managing differences within the empire and as a mode of containing national differences while still keeping this imperial umbrella. It becomes, once we understand this, post-1945 partition becomes almost paradoxically the opposite, because they become quick and dirty exit strategies for the empires as they are collapsing. And this is part of the very interesting dynamic that we have in terms of the political ideas and also the gap between political theory and its actual execution in the post-war years, where it now moves to a level, a new type of international realm. The League of Nations is no longer existing. We have the United Nations, as Laura mentioned, in a way, the United Nations takes this idea and it becomes one of the tools that creates this unique phenomenon that we have in the post-war years, in which nation-state becomes the basic standard unit that we inspire to remodel the entire global map according to it. So in a sense, to put it bluntly, if you want to have membership cards and join the group of nations, you have to declare yourself a nation state. And this is where partition becomes slightly different, because it becomes now a mechanism of creating a nation state that is sovereign and separated, divorced completely from the empire.
I think, too, I mean, one of the interesting things that happens is that in the course of that process, the origin story and the genealogies of partition are actually erased, such that political operatives, especially in more recent decades, have come to think of partition as a kind of neutral solution, right? As a kind of neutral operation that has no backstory, that is simply a parceling out of territory and an acknowledgement of ethnic difference. And that's very dangerous, actually, right? Forgetting the imperial origins of an idea like partition and then redeploying it as some kind of essentially neutral tool of international diplomacy is a very dangerous thing to be doing. So I think that part of our goal in putting this volume together was to put these two halves back into a whole and remind people about the origins of partition as a concept, and think about the ways in which those kinds of that kind of imperial thinking continues to inform recommendations for partition today. Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's exactly the last point I wanted to raise with you and prod you a bit more on this. In fact, the opening line of the introduction, I think, in the opening line, you mentioned that partition is having a moment currently. Laura, you mentioned, or you hinted to alluded to contemporary events. And may I also add to that that for certain ideas of what conflict resolution is or might be, partition has played a role. So, but more broadly, if we were to look at the world today and see parts of the world where conflicts are ongoing, and you know we have international organizations administering or managing forms of partition, what could we say that the relevance of your contribution is to these kinds of debates today in contemporary IER scholarship or in other kinds of fields?
Well, I think that one thing that we want to point out is that partition was originally conceived not because it offered a kind of neutral solution to the problem of ethnic conflict, but because it offered forms of ongoing intervention in the guise of protecting and defending national identities. So I think that continues to be true. I think that advocacy for partition inevitably involves a kind of advocacy for external involvement on the ground, which is often violent. I think we need to remember that when we talk about the abstract concepts of partition, thinking historically, partition has invariably involved an extreme level of violence, and that's what happens when we physically and forcibly try to disentangle populations who necessarily live in mixed spaces, which is true for, you know, across the globe, across history. So I think that, you know, in a way, this is a kind of cautionary tale against seeing partition as a kind of neutral analytical solution to anything. And I would add too that I think that perhaps it also acts as a kind of reminder that the ethnic nation state is a modern phenomenon, that it has been created primarily through the use of a great deal of violence on the ground, and that it's not, historically speaking, the only viable mode of political existence for a state, right? If we imagine ethnic homogeneity to be a requirement for the political viability of a state today, we're going to be looking at an extremely violent future.
And I think that, you know, hit the nail by the head. I mean, I think that in a way, when we read in the news today, we see partition in this way or the other suggested in so many other contexts, sometimes by name. We have propositions to talk about the future of Syria, the future of Iraq, But sometimes it has a different name in the context of Israel-Palestine. When we're talking about the two-state solution, we are actually going back to partition ideas. So in a way, we are calling our readers to avoid this kind of dangerous misreading of history. And there is certainly a bit of a pushback against a tendency to see it as a natural and neutral conflict resolution tool.
Right, thank you. It's about, in a sense, of putting the history of partitions back into understanding it as a practice and how it emerges in 20th century, and also make intellectual historians grapple seriously with such concepts. I understand that thinking and writing about such concepts and might be a bit of a grim thing to do. But I just wanted to end this podcast by, before thanking you, to ask you to share with us potentially a future projects or where you find this set of questions to continue and which directions do you think you might be willing to continue this conversation.
Sure. My next project that I'm just kind of wrapping up at the moment is a history of mass violence in the 20th century Middle East. And I think it does in a way extend from this project that one of the things I really want to do in this project and going forward and kind of set as a research agenda is to think about the ways in which these abstract formulations of political thought, like refugee resettlement or the making of states or migration, are actually inherently violent processes, and to really examine what they look like on the ground as they're unfolding, not as they're being discussed in kind of, you know, international diplomatic halls hundreds or thousands of miles away. So I think it's really crucial when we think about kind of abstract concepts like partition, but also, you know, all of its related phenomena that occur in the making of nation states through the 20th century, to think about the violence that inheres in those processes. And that's what I'm hoping to do in this next project.
The book I'm currently kind of writing is also has clear connections with this project. I'm trying to read again in a new light and from new perspective interwar political theory, and especially the way in which Zionist political thinkers were thinking about nation and state. And I purposely say nation and state because one of the arguments of the book is that nation state as the hyphenated creature was definitely not the default mode of thinking until the late 1930s and partitions. Zionists at earlier stages saw themselves as a minority nationalism and sought to find other types of constellations or programs, autonomy or some sort of a dominion status under the British Empire. And I will bring these Zionist thinkers in conversations with the British imperial thinkers that were thinking about how to rearrange the empire in interwar years under the a bigger umbrella of what they called at the time Third Empire. And therefore kind of a disturb bit the conventional narratives in the history of Zionism that read it through a teleological prism as a thought that is only based on the idea of the nation state from day one, and to see the dynamic that is involved and ending it not necessarily in 1948, meaning with the Israeli independence and the creation of a nascent state and partition, but actually in 1956 and the Suez Crisis, that marks the really last moment in which you still have clear British attempts, involvement in the region and attempt to create sort of a domination by proxy.
Wonderful, wonderful. I'm sure everyone's looking forward to two excellent projects on top of a very interesting volume which we have just discussed. Well, I really wanted to thank you very much for Ari and Laura for making time and for discussing with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.